On this edition for Saturday, November 28th, hospitals brace for a spike in patients as COVID cases continue to climb.
We're all going through the same thing. We're stranded here and we miss home.
And stranded for the holidays, travel restrictions are keeping hundreds of American Samoans from returning to their home. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. More than 13 million people in the United States have now been diagnosed with coronavirus infections since the pandemic arrived here last winter. While most experience mild symptoms and recover, hospitalizations are now rising rapidly. The COVID Tracking Project shows record numbers of COVID-19 patients being hospitalized, close to 90,000 yesterday. In Los Angeles, officials are warning there may be a shortage of hospital beds if cases continue to increase at the current rate. Late yesterday, Los Angeles County issued a new Safer at Home order that will begin Monday and last 3 weeks. The new restrictions urge residents to stay home as much as possible and to wear face coverings when they go out. It bans people from gathering publicly or privately with anyone not in their households. But there are exceptions for church services and protests, which are listed as constitutionally protected rights. For more on the COVID-19 crisis and how one hospital responded early on, I recently spoke with Dr. Adam Jarrett for NJ Spotlight News. He's chief medical officer at Holy Name Medical Center in Teaneck, New Jersey, and author of In the Time of COVID, One Hospital's Struggles and Triumphs.
All right, Dr. Jarrett, let's talk about In the Time of COVID that you have written. And I want to talk to you about a phrase that you have in here. You said after our first confirmed case on March 4th of this year, quote, when I went home that night, I climbed into bed with my wife, exhausted, and for the first time wept, really wept. Please tell us why.
Well, I was worried about the patients we were taking care of, and I was worried about our staff. We knew nothing about this disease. We were very concerned that it was incredibly infectious, which it is. But at that time, we were not confident that normal PPE was going to even protect our staff. We were not confident that we were going to have adequate PPE. I really had visions in my mind at one point of the hospital staff being so decimated that we were not going to be able to take care of our patients. And we'd have patients lined up in hallways. We'd have patients dying, which we did. But I think at that moment, it was really about a fear that we were not going to be able to keep up and that our staff were not going to be able to keep up. And that people that I knew and cared for, staff, were going to potentially get hurt and die. The good news is we kept adequate amounts of PPE, but it was a day-to-day struggle. And we lost over 250 people, patients at Holy Name, and we lost 6 to 8 people who were part of the Holy Name community and family.
Doctor, I noticed throughout the book, your language is blunt. You are very much to the point. And you say at one point, in early March, I made a mistake. What was that mistake?
If I remember correctly, that had to do with bringing the medical staff and the hospital community together so we could learn about this virus. So I set up a meeting for our medical staff and our nurses, and I expected about 50 people to show up, and close to 500 people showed up. Now, even at the time of the meeting, and even several days later, I did not think of that as a mistake. But as we learned about this virus, we realized that our major thing that we can do to protect each other is to socially distance. And I didn't do that at that meeting. And I regret that.
Doctor, you also write about having a plan. Quote, we had thought that this would be a short-term problem that we could handle with only 6 beds in the emergency department. When did reality tell you otherwise?
Relatively quickly. And I think that I personally and Holy Name and the entire country was lulled by past events in the world. We experienced SARS, we experienced Ebola, and we just thought we're not going to have a pandemic. And if we do, we're just not going to have a pandemic. The numbers will be small. And that's literally why we planned for 6 patients. Literally within 5 days of our first known patient, we knew that we were going to have a bigger problem. And we quickly began to adjust the day-to-day at the hospital to be prepared for that. The biggest thing we did was build negative pressure rooms. Very early on, the CDC was very clear in their guidelines that all testing and all treatment of COVID-19 patients should occur in negative pressure rooms because of concern that the virus would aerosolize. We accepted that and knew that that was going to be a potential issue because most hospitals have 10, 12, 15 negative pressure rooms. Throughout the pandemic, we built over 275 rooms and we kept our patients in them.
Doctor, right now in the USA, 257,000 deaths due to COVID. Aren't those persuasive enough for people to say, it's time for me to wear a mask? And if not, what will be persuasive?
I think it is persuasive enough, but obviously there are people out there who do not, and I don't understand that. What I have seen is situations where the disease affects people who I will call anti-maskers. I don't particularly like that term, but I use it in the book, so I'll use it. And I've seen situations where the disease affects people who are anti-maskers, affects their family, and that seems to be what changes their view. And that's unfortunate and that's sad. Put on a mask. You're doing yourself a favor. You're doing the people around you a favor. This disease could not be more real. And we have some very basic things that can make a difference. And it starts with wearing a mask.
Dr. Adam Jarrett is the Chief Medical Officer of Holy Name Medical Center in Teaneck, New Jersey. He's just written a book, In the Time of COVID. Dr. Jarrett, thank you so much.
Michael, take care and stay well.
In Iran today, groups of demonstrators protested the killing of a prominent nuclear scientist who American and Israeli intelligence suspect led Iran's secret nuclear weapons programs. Standing outside the country's Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Parliament, the protesters burned American and Israeli flags and called for Iran to exit the 2015 nuclear deal. President Trump withdrew the United States from the agreement in 2018. The scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, died in a hospital yesterday from injuries sustained after several gunmen fired on his car. President Hassan Rouhani today blamed Israel for the attack, and he, along with Iran's supreme leader, are calling for retaliation for the killing. Ethiopia's prime minister claimed today that his government is now in control of the capital of the region of Tigray. In a tweet, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the city of Mekele is, quote, under command of the National Defense Forces. Tens of thousands of refugees have fled to neighboring Sudan and Eritrea, and UN officials have warned of a humanitarian crisis. The military conflict in Ethiopia began more than 3 weeks ago between the federal government and Tigray's ruling party, which dominated the country until Abiy took power 2 years ago. Tony Hsieh, the former CEO of Zappos, who helped build the online shoe and clothing retailer into a $1 billion company, has died. For 20 years, Hsieh led the online retail giant headquartered in Las Vegas, Nevada. He ran the company based on the philosophy, happy employees lead to happy customers. Hsieh retired earlier this year from Zappos, but continued to be part of the effort to revitalize downtown Las Vegas. Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak tweeted today, Tony Hsieh played a pivotal role in helping transform downtown Las Vegas. Hsieh was surrounded by family in Connecticut,
when he died after being injured in a house fire, according to a spokesperson for his company. Tony Hsieh was 46 years old. For more national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. While the COVID-19 pandemic has touched nearly every country in the world and all 50 United States, one U.S. territory has zero reported cases of the coronavirus. American Samoa shut down its borders and halted all incoming commercial flights in March. But shutting down its borders has come at a cost. Hundreds of American Samoans cannot go home and are stranded across the U.S. NewsHour Weekend's Laura Fong has more.
And every time they always ask, what time are you going to come back home? When are you going to come back home?
Fiti Aina is stranded in Honolulu, Hawaii, 2,600 miles away from his home, his wife Danielle, and their six kids, who are in American Samoa. His youngest, Jelizabeth, just turned a year old last week.
My youngest start walking. It's so hard. I'm not there next to them.
I told my kids, you know, just pray on it. Pray on it.
His wife Danielle works as a sixth grade teacher.
He's not going to be the same. Like, there's always that piece missing. We need to put that piece back in place. That's our only wish, not only me, but my kids too. Like, is to have him home. Have him home for the holidays.
The Aina family live in American Samoa, a U.S. territory with about 55,000 residents and a five-hour flight from Honolulu. In March, American Samoa halted all incoming commercial flights due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Since then, with no commercial flights available, Governor Lolo Matalasi Malinga has allowed two chartered flights to leave the island for those in need of medical treatment, as American Samoa has limited medical resources. Fiti Aina needed gallbladder surgery, and when he got on one of those flights in July, he was told it was a one-way ticket.
It was a sacrifice that I had to make. When I heard there's a one-way ticket, but I was on a plane and praying that one day that they're going to have a flight to go back home, you know.
4 months later, he still doesn't know when he can return home.
You're going to get to that point, you're like getting crushed down, and your hope, it's not there anymore.
Now, Fiti Aina is one of an estimated 562 American Samoa residents trying to get back from the United States. The majority are stranded in Hawaii, Washington State, California, and Utah.
Would you say that most of those folks want to go home in the next few weeks, or if there was a flight in the next few weeks, they would be wanting to get on that flight?
Oh gosh, not most, all. If there was like a flight tomorrow, they would do whatever they can to get home.
Eileen Tyrell is president of Tawata Totu Fa'atasi Alliance of American Samoa. In Samoan, it means people standing together. The alliance is pressing for the American Samoa government to repatriate its citizens as safely and as soon as possible.
It has become a therapeutic platform. It has become an informational hub.
Tyrell began organizing the group when her mother, Mariah Malai Leato, became stranded earlier this year while visiting Tyrell in Washington State. While many American Samoa residents are U.S. nationals, meaning they can work and visit the U.S. easily, some are visiting on visitor visas, like her mother. Tyrell estimates as many as 100 American Samoa residents are stranded here on six-month visas with a costly fee to renew.
A lot of them had already paid out of pocket because they were afraid. They were very afraid of having ICE come after them. And they have had to scramble to pay for the $455 extension visa fee.
I haven't talked to you.
On Friday nights, the Alliance holds a weekly wellness check-in for people to connect and share their stories.
We're all going through the same thing. We're stranded here and we miss home.
People, they go through depression, they go through grief, they go, you know, it's a matter of how they process, you know, and what they're able to process. It has been an emotional journey, financial strain for the families.
There is also the fear of getting the coronavirus.
According to the Pacific Islander COVID-19 response team, Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders contract the virus at disproportionately high rates in states where data is collected by race. In Hawaii, Pacific Islanders, including Samoans, are the most likely to be hospitalized or die from the coronavirus more than any other racial or ethnic group.
And is that a concern of some of your stranded residents here, that they could get COVID?
Oh gosh, that's a concern for everybody, every single person. My biggest fear is that someone of the stranded residents who is waiting will get the virus and die. Samoans, Pacific Islanders in general, they live in multi-generational homes because, you know, family is such a huge thing for them.
While Fiti Aina was waiting in Hawaii to go home, he found out that he has an enlarged heart, putting him at high risk for complications if he contracts COVID-19.
It's hard for me to go find a job. If I'm going to get the virus, it's an end game for me.
Back in American Samoa, a COVID-19 task force and the local health department have outlined a 4-stage repatriation plan, including a 10-day quarantine in Honolulu before the flight home and a 14-day quarantine after arrival. Earlier this month, the governor approved a provisional date for January 19th for the first repatriation flight. Aina doesn't know if he will be on that flight or if it will be delayed, but for him and his family, it could not come soon enough.
We're continuing our series, Turning Points, stories produced, directed, and told by Indigenous people from Yellowknife in Canada's Northwest Territories. It's part of an empowerment journalism project in partnership with the Global Reporting Center.
Yes, good morning. My mom needs an appointment to see her doctor. She's getting old. She's 95. She needs somebody there. Go visit her, do laundry for her, cook for her. Okay, I'm gonna make some bannock. We're still working out a lot of things, but it's a lot better than 30 years ago. After I got out of residential school, I was angry at my mom for a long time. I said, I blame them, I guess. 7 years old, don't know why they sent me there. They were all strangers to me. Nuns were all black, dressed in black. I lost my language, my culture. Yeah, I even lost myself. I just measured my flower. When I was 13, 14, I wasn't getting no support from my parents too, so I ran away. I was homeless for a long time. I watched people drink, I thought they had fun. I had older friends, you know, they went to parties, so I went with them. That's how I started drinking. I used to go to jail, I used to go to Jung Tang, I used to go on the street, like on the schedule, you know, many times. Because of alcohol and unhealthy relationship with the person I was with. I had my children were taken away. I was homeless for a long time. And I didn't know how to be a parent. I had to learn pretty fast to be a mom. I tried many times to sober up. I went for treatments. In the last 20 years, you know, I went for treatment. Never worked because I didn't want it to work. It's not easy to change, you know. It took me many years to sober up, you know. It's not easy to sober up, you know. I did it. Anybody could do it. Oh, should be done. Oh, yeah. Right on. It's hot. Oof. Okay, it's done. But eventually, I forgave my mom. I'm closer to her now. Today, I'm having a better relationship with her. She tells me old stories about her when she was young, and she taught me how to sew. Yeah, I pass it on to my girls. I got three daughters. And my oldest daughter, she loves sewing now. She does some beadwork now. Yeah, she's doing some beadwork. You know, it makes me so proud. At least I taught them something, you know, at least something, you know, I taught them. She loves it. Every time I pick a bead, you know, it's keeping away from my addiction. I'll go further away from my addiction, and I go closer to my mom. Yeah, that's I guess that's the way I like to think about it now. Yeah.
Finally tonight, at a ceremony in St. Peter's Basilica at the Vatican today, Pope Francis elevated 13 new cardinals, the highest rank in the Roman Catholic Church. The 13 include Washington, D.C.'s Wilton Gregory, the Catholic Church's first African-American cardinal. Wilton, who is 72, was one of several new cardinals who were quarantined for about 10 days ahead of this ceremony because of coronavirus concerns. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Michael Hill. Thanks for watching, and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.